It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The latest census of agriculture shows a continuing decline of farms in Wisconsin, and the decline of dairy operations is even more dramatic.
Many family farms are struggling to generate enough income to support the business. Some have had to supplement their earnings with other jobs off of the farm.
Steve Deller researches the connections between farming and rural economies as a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison and a Division of Extension Community Economic Development Specialist. Steve, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning.
Well, lay it out for us. What kind of declines are you seeing in Wisconsin farms?
We're seeing kind of with the latest census that came out, we're seeing kind of a return to the decline in the number of farms. This has been a pattern that's been going on since World War II. We're seeing basically consolidation. Farms are getting bigger. It's economies of scale. There was a period in the 1980s and 1990s where it kind of stabilized a little bit, but we're seeing that pattern of further consolidation returning.
Particularly dramatic, you point out in your data, 17,000 dairy farms in 2002, around 6,000 dairy farms in 2022. That's a big decline.
It is a big decline. What we're seeing a lot of times is that these, as the farmers get older and they're looking at retirement and whatnot, the next generation really isn't necessarily interested in it. Newer farmers that are trying to get in, it's an extremely expensive business to get into, and it's really difficult for young beginning farmers to get the funding. So many of these farmers basically find themselves having to get out of dairy. Some are shifting over to beef, so they still have cattle, but they're not milking. And what they're doing is they're selling their herds off to other larger farms, furthering the consolidation. So the number of dairy of milking cows is actually relatively stable. It goes up and down a little bit. But what we're seeing is that more and more of those, that herd is being concentrated in fewer, larger farms.
As you see this consolidation, you're making some connections here to off-the-farm jobs. What are you seeing there?
The traditional thought is that for a healthy rural economy, you have to have healthy agriculture. The flow of economic benefits goes from the farm to the rural communities. But when you start to look at the financing of the farm family or the farm household, the data is really suggesting something very, very different. Historically, a farm family, someone would get a job off-farm primarily to get health insurance. Increasingly, that off-farm income is keeping the farm afloat. It's keeping the family afloat. And because the family is now financially stable because of that off-farm income, the farm is able to continue to operate. Even for the biggest farms, farms that have sales of over $1 million, there's still about 15% of the farm family income is coming from off-farm. I would imagine that those farms, they're looking for health insurance.
So there's also a narrative here that you're pointing out. It's the consistency and the reliability of that paycheck, which is coming from this off-farm employment, that you don't really have sometimes with the ups and downs of farming.
Exactly. It creates stability and predictability for the family, which allows them to be able to keep that farm going through periods of up and down. And agriculture, by its very nature, is it goes through periods of ups and downs, and farmers have become pretty savvy at negotiating. When it's good times, how do we take advantage of that to prepare for the lean years? Farmers have gotten pretty good at that, but with that off-farm income, they don't have to worry about the family quite as much.
These surrounding rural communities, are there reliable, meaningful off-farm jobs available to these farmers?
It is, particularly if you look at, maybe not the community that is, just down the road from the farm, but if you start to look at a reasonable commuting distance, it really kind of opens up a lot of opportunities. And when you get into many of these rural communities, there's still labor shortages. We've been generating more jobs than we have people for years. And while we had a labor shortage before COVID, coming out of COVID, it's kind of in our face. So the opportunity for off-farm employment is actually pretty good, particularly if you're willing to drive a little bit.
Willing to drive a little bit. We are talking about the relationship between Wisconsin farms and their surrounding rural communities with UW-Madison Agricultural and Applied Economics Professor Steve Deller. You know, I want to touch down just a bit more here on healthcare. How much is the story about acquiring healthcare coverage and, you know, family farms seeking that money for benefits and insurance?
That's been true for decades. So that's there's almost always been some off-farm income coming in, but the income is secondary to the health insurance. That pattern has changed. Now it's the income. The health insurance is important. That's oftentimes a major motivation. Historically, that had been the motivation, but increasingly, it is the income is keeping the family stable.
I'm curious. The breakdown of who goes to get these off-farm jobs and the responsibilities there. Do you have any gender breakdowns in the research? Is it more farm women going off the farm?
Not in this particular study.
Huh.
We don't have that kind of detailed information. But there has been a relative explosion of women farmers. And women farmers... we have a second research project that is looking at how women farmers kind of view the farm a little bit differently than their traditional kind of male farmer. We're seeing with the growth of local foods, with the growth of, I don't like the phrase alternative agriculture, but I'll go with it. You know, these are kind of like goat milking farms and things like that. They tend to be dominated by women farmers. Mm-hmm. And women farmers... you know, really view their farms in a more holistic way, if you will. They think of the farm a little bit differently than their male counterparts. That could be changing a little bit. So traditionally, it would be the male spouse runs the farm, the female spouse or partner gets the off-farm job. We're seeing evidence of that changing. We're seeing evidence of women now operating the farm, and the male spouse is the one with the off-farm job.
Interesting.
It's rare. The dynamics are really changing. We're also seeing a growth in the number of partners, where both the male and female, the husband and wife, are actually now saying, we run this farm as a team.
The dynamics of holding down two full-time jobs, the farm job, the off-farm job, what does that do to stress?
Oh, it's tremendous. And that's why this off-farm income kind of helps take some of that stress off, because you know now that the family is stable, but it is, it's a lot of work. It's a labor of love to do a lot of this stuff. And I think that's why subsequent generations are not really interested in taking over the family farm, because they see what mom and dad are doing. And they're going, I don't want to do that. You're actually having instances where the parents are saying, you don't want to do this. Get a college degree, get a technical degree, do something other than this, because it's backbreaking, it's stressful, and you're burning both ends of the candle at once, particularly if you have livestock. If you're a crop farmer, that's a little bit different because your commitment to being on the farm for crops is really intense at planting and harvesting.
Sure.
But you got more flexibility. If you have
You have to deal with Mother Nature.
Exactly. If you have livestock, you have to be on that farm 24/7.
What is the message here for policymakers when you look at these shifts?
I think the takeaway from this research is that we have to think about the relationship between the farm and rural communities differently. It had always been, as I mentioned, the idea that a healthy rural economy is dependent upon healthy agriculture. I think that relationship has flipped. And the policy implication is that if you want to maintain a farming economy, you want to maintain those family farms, those medium-sized, intermediate-sized farms, you have to make sure that there's off-farm employment that has benefits, good-paying off-farm employment that has good benefits. So the idea is that now we have to look at this more holistically, and we have to look at, how does farming and the local business community kind of, how do we work together more?
What do we lose when we lose the small family farm?
I think it's part of our culture. I think it's part of our kind of the way that we view ourselves from a purely economic perspective. If I put my cold-hearted economist hat on, these really small farms don't impact the local economy that much. But it's a cultural dimension. Mm-hmm. It is it's part of who we are.
There's pride in it.
There's pride in it. Mm-hmm. It's part of our identity. Also, if you look at things like farmers markets, a lot of the farmers markets, a lot of the local foods are these smaller farms. Mm-hmm. So if we want to maintain, farmers markets, local food systems, in order for those farms, that they tend to be smaller, to maintain, there has to be off-farm income.
Where does your research on this head next? What are you watching for?
One of the things that we just put out a study with two colleagues from Penn State University is how the women farmers kind of, the way that they approach their farming, how does that impact the local community differently than their male farmers? And we do find that there is a big difference. A really big difference because women farmers are more holistic in how they view things, and that has a positive spillover in the local community. Also, women farmers are more likely to be involved in local foods. They're more likely to be at the farmers markets. They're more likely to be supplying organic eggs to the local restaurants, organic chicken to the local restaurants.
Very involved in the local community. Steve,
yes.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Deller is UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, with us to share how Wisconsin farms are increasingly relying on surrounding rural communities for off-farm employment.
Coming up, a Wisconsin expert on air quality and climate change shares a new effort to bring science messages to the public.
The goal here is just to make a lot of the science around climate change more accessible and relevant to everyday people.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In an election cycle that's had more than its share of ups and downs, the top issue has remained steady. Joe Schultz reports on how the economy has stayed front of mind for voters and how it's playing out in this year's campaigns.
On a recent Wednesday, shoppers pushed grocery carts through the parking lot of an Oshkosh Pick and Save. Others opened their trunks and began to load their groceries. One of those shoppers is Lynn Reichenberger, a retiree on a fixed income. She doesn't think the economy is particularly good or bad, but somewhere in between. She says inflation has been a challenge, but she still tries to support local businesses.
Me and my husband try to go at least once a week, but even those prices are getting horrible.
Other shoppers that day say they're feeling the compounding effect of price increases in recent years.
I got three bags of groceries over $100. That's crazy.
Things are expensive, but it seems like some things are starting to come down in price.
I'm working overtime to try and compensate the increase in prices.
If you see the prices and everywhere is going up.
That was Don Wyman, Lisa Zemlock, Natalie Myrick, and Anton Wee, all from Oshkosh. While they held different views on politics, they shared a common sentiment when it comes to one of this year's biggest campaign issues. A Marquette University Law School poll released last week showed that the economy remained the top issue for Wisconsin voters. 37% of voters called the economy their most important issue this election. No other issue was even close. Former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris both say they want to bring costs down for consumers, but they've offered starkly different visions.
Together we will deliver low taxes, low regulations, low energy costs, low interest rates, and low inflation.
We will create what I call an opportunity economy, where everyone has the chance to compete.
Harris has proposed cracking down on price gouging in the grocery industry. She also proposed expanding tax credits to small businesses, parents, and first-time homebuyers. Trump has proposed a 60% tariff on imports from China and up to 20% on all other imports. He also wants to extend and deepen the 2017 tax cuts on higher earners and corporations. Trump's plan has drawn criticism from economists who say his tariffs would lead to higher prices for consumers. Menzie Chin is a macroeconomist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Trump's tariffs can have a big impact on the economy in a negative fashion by spurring uncertainty to higher levels or increasing inflationary pressures.
Kurt Bauer is president of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. It's the state's largest business group. Bauer says he's not in favor of Trump's tariffs, but he prefers the former president's policies when it comes to taxes and deregulation.
Trump wants to take the corporate rate from 21% to 20%, 15% for manufacturers, and Harris wants to take it to 28%, which would be above the global average. So we would argue that that would be an uncompetitive rate.
Meanwhile, organized labor groups have largely endorsed Harris, who they say would better support unions. Laura Dresser is with the High Road Strategy Center. It's a worker-focused economic think tank at UW-Madison. She says Harris's plan seems focused on building the middle class.
Those do feel like kind of a deep middle focus, kind of a making opportunity more real for more people, rather than an elite kind of tax breaks at the top or trickle-down approach.
The economy has shown positive signs recently. The inflation rate hit its lowest level since 2021. Unemployment in Wisconsin remains near record lows. But 63% of Wisconsin voters still had a negative view of the economy in Marquette's latest poll, which is why the issue has remained front and center in this election. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
October is here, even if the air doesn't have that signature Wisconsin chill quite yet.
The end of September brought some good air quality around the state, but right now the state DNR has its eyes on what was a low point when we had day after day of bad air quality days because of smoke from Canadian wildfires last year.
Even now, parts of the southern border of Canada are under an extreme fire danger risk, and environmental scientists are digging into lessons from those days of wildfire smoke and what they can teach us about wider issues of air quality and climate change.
Tracy Holloway is a professor at UW-Madison in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. She's also part of a nonprofit called Science Moms, who teach people about how climate change affects kids. Tracy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Rob.
Before we get into some of the particulars of air quality, I want to talk about a wider effort that you're part of taking what we know about air quality, environmental science, and climate change and bringing it to the public in maybe a different way than people are used to. Can you talk a little bit about what you've been working on?
Sure. For the last few years, I've been part of an initiative called Science Moms. And the goal here is just to make a lot of the science around climate change more accessible and relevant to everyday people. And there's a lot of different science outreach efforts. But until the Science Moms program, none had really been targeted at moms who are always thinking about what's happening 10, 20, 30 years down the road as we are trying to make the future better for our kids. So I'm a mom and I'm a scientist, and it's been really fun to be part of this program that's trying to bring those two issues together.
I want to dig into one issue now that the state is working on, looking back at the wildfire smoke from last year. Now, the wildfires were happening, of course, in Canada, but last summer we had so many days where we could smell wildfire smoke where it had a potential health impact here. Lived in the Midwest for over five decades, and I can't think back to a time where that was something I even thought about. Can you talk, first of all, about what we were seeing? Remind us what we were seeing last summer.
Last summer here in Wisconsin, we had unprecedented levels of air pollution. And the main one that we talk about is particulate matter. And we talk especially about what's called fine particulate matter, or PM2.5. And these are suspended particles of solid or liquid that are associated with respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, they make our eyes itch, and they even shorten life expectancy. So these are a big issue for public health, and actually they've been regulated in the United States for decades. Unfortunately, we can't control every source of particulate matter, and the big wildfires in Canada are a great example of sources beyond our control.
Now, that's something that caught our eye. The state DNR is doing an exceptional event demonstration. This is a technical thing that they are doing to satisfy some federal requirements, as I understand it. Can you talk us through what the kind of things they're looking at and why they're doing it now?
Absolutely. The exceptional event rule is from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. And it basically offers a way for states to strike air pollution days that are really outside of their control. One way to contextualize this is to think about it like students and grades, because the federal EPA sets a limit on how clean the air has to be in every state in the United States. We all have the same limit that we're trying to hit. And we have little instruments across the state that are, or big instruments, they're housed in trailers, that measure the air every hour of every day. And one of the big metrics that the state is focused on right now is if you take the measurements from the whole year and average them together, is it cleaner or dirtier than we are allowed to be to meet the Clean Air Act rule? And just earlier this year, in early 2024, the threshold of what was considered clean enough got tightened. So actually, we're trying to meet a cleaner air pollution standard than we've ever had to meet before, while at the same time, we have this unprecedented high levels of smoke coming in from Canada that are beyond our control. So there's a challenge that Wisconsin faces, and many, many states are facing it right now, where they're trying to meet a stricter grading scale at the same time having all this smoke coming in that they couldn't do anything about no matter what their in-state policies were.
Tracy, when it comes to air quality, take out the wildfire smoke for just a moment. I've seen you quoted elsewhere saying there's some good news. We have some room for optimism. We've actually been making progress for the most part on our air quality. What have you seen?
It is a good news story, except for wildfires. In Wisconsin and across the United States, our air has been getting cleaner and cleaner for all of the health-relevant pollutants that are regulated under the Clean Air Act. And this is due to cleaner cars, cleaner power plants, cleaner industry. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize how much we've done since 1970 to make our air clean and healthy, and how much we're already doing and continue to do. So every year, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources comes out with a report tracking how clean our air is getting. And this reports information from monitors all across the state that are measuring our air. And it is a good news story for everything within our control. And that's why it's important to make sure that we're not being unfairly penalized for air pollution coming in from Canada due to wildfires.
I will say, getting back to the bad news, last year, I think for the first time in my life, I got hooked on watching those air quality maps for Wisconsin, for where my kids are going to college. What can we take in our personal lives and do with that information? How much control do we have over our lives when there's that much particulate matter in our air?
That is a really good question, because there's some things we can do and some things we can't do. When we're outside in high air pollution situations, the best measure you can take is to wear a mask, like those N95 masks that you may have in your drawer from the pandemic days. But when you're indoors, there's actually a lot you can do. because there are a lot of steps we can take to create cleaner air in our indoor environment. And there are air purifiers that you can buy from the store or from online, but you can actually make your own air purifier using a common box fan and paper HEPA filters and duct tape that studies have shown works just as well as many of the store-bought models. So it doesn't have to be a major investment to make a pretty effective air purifier for your indoor air.
We are talking about air quality, wildfires, and our personal health with Tracy Holloway, environmental science professor at UW-Madison. Tracy, you lead a team for NASA called the Health and Air Quality Applied Sciences Team, looking deeply at the kind of things we're talking about right now. Can you talk about your work with NASA a little bit and the kinds of things you're doing to help us connect the dots between our air and our well-being?
Well, it's been really exciting over the last decade or so to see how satellites up in space can provide information that is so useful to people on the ground. And one example of how we can use satellite data is in terms of figuring out, is an air pollution event due to local sources or is it due to wildfires in Canada? And when we have just one monitor and the data from the monitor, that doesn't tell us where it came from. But up in space, looking down, you can see these big plumes of smoke moving across wide areas. But we can even see with satellites chemicals in the air that are invisible to our human eye. And that helps us see whether some neighborhoods may be breathing dirtier air than other neighborhoods, or how individual sources are contributing to air pollution problems. So it's been really exciting to be at the forefront of this, working with NASA and states across the country and organizations around the world who are excited about the new technology to support clean air.
Are we getting to a point where we can have really solid predictions, kind of like a weather forecast, but instead of, you know, rain coming in 3 days, this wildfire plume, it's likely to descend down to ground level in 3 days, so plan accordingly, or ozone-causing chemicals are going to concentrate in this area. Are we getting better at forecasting these things?
Yes, we are absolutely getting better at forecasting air pollution, in part because of the data from the satellites that helps us see what's happening over oceans or over continents, even where we don't have a lot of data. Actually, both the EPA and some of our phone-based apps have these air pollution forecasts available, and they can be really helpful in terms of planning out what day you might run, whether to run tomorrow or to go ahead and run today, or other activities that might be affected by visibility or by having good air to breathe. So the forecast is really a growing area of science, and it's something that's being implemented by our own government, by private companies. And actually, just this month, the State Department rolled out a new air quality forecast around the world based on some of the work out of the NASA team that I lead.
Bringing things kind of full circle, we know climate change is raising our risk of a lot of different disastrous events. We're getting maybe better at predicting some of these things like air quality, but I think there could be a feeling of powerlessness. If you're breathing wildfire smoke in the Midwest that's coming from Canada, well, we can't put out those wildfires from here. If we watch those hurricanes plunge further and further inland, can you talk about ways that people can feel empowered to try to deal with some of the root causes that make these disasters more disastrous?
Well, one of the reasons I really have enjoyed working with the Science Moms program is because they've helped distill a lot of complex competing issues into some news you can use. And they have a three-step to-do list to help take control of climate change. And one is to swap, which is to say, when you're making a big purchase, think about whether this is something that can be moving us forward in a clean energy way, like energy efficient dishwasher or a heating system with a heat pump or an electric vehicle, those kind of things. Two is to share. The biggest thing people can do to make a change is to talk about issues, and especially things like climate change that sometimes get politicized. If people are talking in their community or talking with their friends and just making these issues more normal to have as part of our decision-making process, as opposed to something that people don't want to talk about because it might offend somebody. And I'd say the third issue is to speak up on issues that you care about when we have opportunities with the elections or with our community decision-making or with what kind of school buses to be buying for our kids. Any of these things, there's a lot of opportunities in our democracy to speak up on issues you care about. And so swap, share, and speak up are kind of the three-part system that the Science Moms have come up with.
Something I always wonder when I'm talking to somebody who's really focusing up close on the impacts of climate change, how optimistic are you, or pessimistic, or the mix thereof, when you look at our short and medium-term future?
I am really an optimist because I think about the successes that we've had as humans overcoming big problems. And just in my area of work related to chemicals in the air, air pollution was getting dirtier and dirtier through the 1960s. And then in 1970, the Clean Air Act was passed. We turned a corner and our air has been getting healthier ever since then. And in 1985, we discovered the ozone hole over Antarctica. And then 2 years later, 1987, we passed the Montreal Protocol. And now the ozone hole is in recovery. So climate change is not something that will be solved overnight. But when my kids look back on the 2020s, I would love it if they said that is when we turned a corner on climate change and we started moving in the direction of a solution.
Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's really been a pleasure.
Tracy Holloway is a professor at UW-Madison in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences.
Coming up, Wisconsin landowners are teaming up with a conservation group to create a 50-mile trail in Wisconsin's Driftless area.
We're doing this work now so that generations of people can continue to experience this and enjoy it in the way that we've been so fortunate to be able to.
The Driftless Trail Project, that's ahead on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the Ice Age Trail, that 1,200-mile-long path winding across landscapes carved by glaciers in Wisconsin through the ages.
Now there's another trail in the works exploring the special part of Wisconsin where no glaciers roamed, the Driftless area.
The Driftless Area Land Conservancy has kicked off a 50-mile trail project connecting three state parks, that is Blue Mound, Tower Hill, and Governor Dodge.
Barb Barzin is the Community Conservation Specialist for the Driftless Area Land Conservancy, and Emily Butler is Vice President of Partnerships for the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, which is turning two sections of its land into conservation easements to be part of the Driftless Trail. Emily, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
And Barb, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. This is a great conversation to look forward to.
And now the idea for this Driftless Trail, I understand, has been a while in the making. Can you tell us about the origins of putting this together?
Yeah, so our previous executive director, Dave Clutter, lived in Madison and commuted out to the Driftless Area Land Conservancy's office in Dodgeville for a number of years. And he finally got tired of just being able to drive through this beautiful country and not be able to get out and hike it. And he wanted to be able to go camping with his kids in this. So he started out with the idea as just a recreational opportunity. But the more he talked about it, the more it seemed like a really great land conservation strategy as well. And part of our organization's mission as a land trust is to connect people with this landscape. So it just started to roll from there. He contracted with the National Park Service to help us develop the concept plan for it. And I jumped in as a contractor during that whole process. We did a couple of public meetings just to kind of bounce this idea off of the public in I think four different communities that this trail will go through or go near. and seemed to get enough positive feedback that we decided to go for it. And we had a few landowners step up to offer to host the trail. So the stars just started aligning in a way that we decided, okay, this is worth the leap, because it's a very ambitious vision. The whole idea is to connect Tower Hill, Governor Dodge, and Blue Mound State Parks with a quiet trail, just a footpath. And it will cross, even though it will connect state properties, it will cross primarily private lands. So finding enough landowners in alignment to make that happen is a bit of a leap of faith.
That does sound complicated, Barb. Can you talk about how that's going, how people have responded, people who own the land that could be part of this trail?
Yeah, well, you know, our first segment that we opened was with a woman whose parents bought a farm just north of Governor Dodge State Park back in the 1960s. It's a large property with a couple of valleys. And as we were doing a conservation easement with her, she said, you know, I really don't go down into this valley all that much. And she really believes in the concept of public access on private lands. And so we started there. And so that's the Weaver Road segment. It was the first one that we opened up. And it's a beautiful 1.1 mile, what we call a lollipop loop. It's part out and back and part loop. Goes way down into a valley. So you start really high with an amazing view all the way up to the lower Wisconsin River, and then get way down into a valley and walk along the base of a pine relict, which is a really classic Driftless area feature. And then there's another couple about 4 miles east of there that does a lot of hiking in Europe. And of course, in Europe, the whole concept of public access on private property is just baked into the culture. And so they run a grass-fed beef operation on just a beautiful large property. So we put 2.7 miles of trail on their land. And that is what we call our Knobs Road segment. And then Emily can speak to this, but as soon as we start talking about this idea, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation that owns and manages the Frank Lloyd Wright Taliesin Estate was all over this. You know, it just really aligns with the values and the concept of what they're doing there.
Emily, let's bring you in on this now. We were just hearing Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation leaped at this opportunity, it sounds like. Tell us about why you wanted to participate in the Driftless Trail.
Yeah, absolutely. So this land really inspired Frank Lloyd Wright. You know, this is where he is from. He spent his childhood here. So fundamentally, all of his architecture and all of his ideas about architecture actually come from where we are right now and where this trail is. So the opportunity for the foundation and for Taliesin to be more integrated into the community and to provide new opportunities for visitors to experience Taliesin and this land in a way that Frank Lloyd Wright would have been able to and that inspired him really advances our mission, and it means a lot to us. And I think it's a win-win-win.
Emily, paint us a picture of the land by Taliesin that the trail's going through. Some hills, Barb mentioned.
Yeah. So we are in the Driftless here. So this lovely rolling hill. So actually, out of my window here, I'm actually looking at the Welsh Hills. And there are three beautiful hills. And they are, again, this inspiration for Frank Lloyd Wright's landscape. And so the Welsh Hills trails kind of gently goes back and forth and rolls up and down these hills. And as you're up there, you can actually look back and see the entire Taliesin property. And then Phoebe Point, which happens to be my favorite section of the trail here, is a little bit more hidden. It is an opportunity for visitors to walk through a beautiful wooded area. And they're actually, as they walk up, going to be able to see different kinds of restoration projects. We've been trying to restore our oak savanna and different landscapes, natural landscapes here at Taliesin over the years. So the visitors kind of walk through that process. And at the end, they get to this beautiful overlook where you can see a little bit of Taliesin and a lot of the Wisconsin River.
We're talking about the construction of the Driftless Trail, which will one day connect three state parks in the Driftless area. We have Emily Butler with us from the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, as we heard, their land part of the trail, and Barb Barzin, Community Conservation Specialist for the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. Barb, it's one thing for Taliesin to host some of the trail. When you're talking with private landowners, you know, maybe they live on part of this property, are there concerns about, you know, having a trail running through their back 40 or whatever the case may be?
Oh, sure. There's always some resistance to it. People are kind of unsure about how their land is going to be treated. But from the very beginning, we've been working really closely with the Ice Age Trail Alliance, since they've got, they're like 600 miles into their built constructing their 1,000-mile trail that goes, a lot of it is on private lands. And so we picked their brains a lot when we first got this going, and they've been just really generous. And they have found, with all of their experience over 60 years now, that the type of people that use a quiet trail like this tend to be very, very respectful. And even at the, now that they've had the Welsh Hills Trail open for 4 years now, I think, Emily, one of their staff people said that they've maybe picked up one piece of trash on that trail in the whole 4 years that it's been open. So we feel very confident when we tell people, private landowners that we're talking to about hosting the trail, that these hikers tend to be very respectful. They're there for a quiet trail experience, and they want to leave it the way that they found it, and they want to make sure that other people can experience it the way that they did. So we understand that there are certain issues that we have to work through, and we're just being very patient and not trying to cram anything down anybody's throat. There's no government and agencies involved in this. We don't take anybody's land. It's all totally volunteer. And so far, the kind of landowners that we have been able to line up are just right on board with this whole idea, and they're trying to make it happen right alongside us.
Emily, I understand you're on a team that's starting to develop an interpretive plan for this trail. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a really important part of this. I think, you know, while we want people to just be immersed in nature and be able to experience it for themselves, I think that certain users of the trail will get a lot out of having some kind of interpretation, so they understand the history of the land, the change over time, the impact that it has on their life today. So coming at it from an architectural historian perspective, we're really excited to be able to tell the story of this land from the perspective of Frank Lloyd Wright and his family. But I think at a broader level, this area is so rich in history. So to be able to have an interpretation of this will really add to the value of the trail itself.
Barb, what does the timeline look like for developing the trail?
Oh, it's just one step at a time. And we kind of guess it'll be like a 20-year horizon. But we said that 5 years ago, and we're still saying 20 years. So it's a slow process, and I'm sure that we'll pick up steam as we go along. But we have everybody. We don't put trail on anyone's property unless we have an easement, either a conservation easement on the whole property or a trail easement for just the trail corridor. And that legal process takes a lot of time. It's just really hard to say. And we don't have the whole thing routed, obviously. I mean, we have kind of a 6 or 8 mile stretch at a time, and we have just a really general ideas where the trail will go. But it's a slow and patient process, and that's the way it should be, and that's the way it will always be. Trying to put some sort of an endpoint on it is just folly. And plus, you know, if people get really excited about this, there are so many ways we could go. We could go, you know, keep going west to the Snow Bottom area by Highland. We could go south into the amazingly rich grassland region south of Barneveld. Driftless Trail, it's a very general term. We have a 50-mile loop in mind right now, but it could grow from there. You never know. And there's also a Minnesota Driftless Trail. So, you know, if you're thinking 50 miles out, we could somehow connect with the Minnesota Driftless Trail.
Emily, what is it like to be part of this long-term process that ultimately is going to create something that's going to bring people in to really appreciate this this area you live and work in?
So we're doing this work now so that generations of people can continue to experience this and enjoy it in the way that we've been so fortunate to be able to. And I'll just say that it's a joy because there's such a wonderful group of people who are working on this. And ever since I've kind of come to this region, I've just been immersed in the passion that everyone here has for this land and for this property and for this project. So it has been really exciting to be a part of something much greater that will connect different communities, different landscapes, and tell a really wonderful story.
And Barb, an important point here, you mentioned it might be 20-ish years before the whole thing is done. We could start hiking it, you know, tomorrow, right? You've got, I think, 7-ish miles. You described some of the existing paths so far. Mm-hmm. What in the fall, what are some of your favorite things to see this time of year on these trails?
Oh, just the colors. When you put the colorful leaves up against the amazing rock cliffs, you know, it's just an iconic Driftless area experience. Weaver Road Trail is particularly beautiful in the fall. I mean, they're all just really beautiful. So, yeah. And if I could say a word about the conservation value of this, we have found that the more that we develop this trail, the educational value of it just really pops out, which is why we're really excited about this interpretive plan, but also the conservation value of it, the land conservation value. We would not be having all these conversations with landowners were it not for this project. And to date, we have legally protected 470 acres in our project area solely because we're having these conversations about this project with landowners. And it's really a one thing leads to another. As we're digging in the dirt and putting in trail, we're finding rare plants, and we just found a really cool rare rock on the Taliesin property. Geologists are pretty excited about, and so then that gets the landowner excited, and then we also try to say, okay, you know, you've got some really great oak savanna or prairie here, and here are some resources that you can tap into if you want to help to manage that property. So it really is a one thing leads to another, and it's been really shown that developing corridors will create a climate resilient landscape, and it'll create a wildlife corridor and for both plants and animals to move as it's kind of scaling up our conservation, land conservation efforts by creating this long corridor. So this project is valuable on multiple fronts, including land conservation.
Barb, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's a great opportunity. Thank you.
And Emily, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Barb Barzin is the Community Conservation Specialist for the Driftless Area Land Conservancy, and Emily Butler is Vice President of Partnerships for the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation. They talked to us about the creation of the Driftless Trail.
Coming up later this week, we'll visit this year's Farm Art Detour in rural Sauk County. The second weekend of the event is coming up, and Rob, you did the tour last weekend.
That's right. I always try to make the tour, long story short, it's a road trip in a wide rural area with big art installations on farms, roadside poetry, farm stands, and performances, all with that amazing driftless scenery. They do this every other year.
Any highlights you can share?
Yeah, I got to see a ballet performed on farm equipment. That's not something you're going to see everywhere.
It is not. If you have any favorites from the Farm Art Detour, past or present, tell us about it. Call 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.